This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Okay, we're going to get started. I've got good news and I've got even better news. The good news is that if we do run over time, there'll be an announcement at about 4:45 telling us to get out of the building. If that happens, then we're all going up to the University House bar to continue the conversation there. Now, the even better news is that our last speaker today is Paul Tapsell. I don't think Paul needs much of an introduction to anyone working in the field of repatriation. He has a long and distinguished career, both in universities and in museums. In fact, he's kind of interesting in as much as he combines those two worlds in excellent ways, but also has been fundamentally important in terms of the repatriation of ancestral remains, old people, but also of cultural treasures back to Māori. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to introduce my good friend and colleague, Paul.
Tēnā koe, ko te mea tuatahi, te kōrero tīmata maku ki tō tātou kāinga. My first words to our creator, however we may envisage that person to bring us together in the space of consciousness in this moment. Ko te mea tuarua, e ngai tua marae maha o tēnei whenua o Ngānawo, te iwi o Ngānawo, haere atu rā. And secondly, I acknowledge the land on which we are meeting today, and the people that are today's custodians, the Ngānawo, for all those who have passed on this land, and I farewell them so that we, the living, can get involved in this most important discussion that we've had today. Thirdly, ko te mea tuaturi, e ngā mana ngā reo, e ngā mātā waka, e ngā rangatira rau, tēnā koutou, kia ora hui hui mai nei tātou, tēnei rā. And I acknowledge all of you for being here today. I also take the moment to acknowledge my peers, my relations, Ngāti Tūwhare Tō, just walking in the door, Cressida and Paul and Gareth for organising our esteemed rangatira, or the Ainu, Ngā mihi ki a koutou, e ngā rangatira o Japan, ngā Ainu, the true Japanese people. And finally, also to Matthew for providing this venue for us to meet today, who has been really appreciative of the work that we've done in the space of repatriation and has showing, I think, the long-term view, vision and courage that we need in Australia. I don't say that lightly, having recently been working in the Museums Victoria, working with the Donald Thompson Collection, working with a number of our colleagues there at the University of Melbourne as well as the other universities, and realising just how politically fraught it can be, as I found out as a young person, to organise the return of communities' ancestors. And the issues we're dealing with here are the issues of politics of returns. And as much as we know what's right and what should be done, there's always other agendas occurring. And until we become aware of those agendas, we'll always be hitting our head against the brick wall. So my very brief talk today, given that we'll get the alarm to get the heck out of here, revolves actually around an old Māori saying. Whenever we meet someone, we don't ask you, what's your name or who are you? We ask, nō hea koe, which, as my old people would say, doesn't mean where are you from, it means where are your bones from? Who are your bones? And it relates to everything I've heard today, that the country is our ancestors. The country is made up of the DNA of our skeletal remains of our ancestors that have been put back into the land to replenish Papa Tuanuku, have been reintegrated into a space of belonging back in the womb. And in doing that, our physical essence returning to the land, our spiritual essence returns back to Sky Father, and we integrate into the universe. So our consciousness is released again to reintegrate in another time, another place, in other ways, out of which we all finally must cross through a threshold, that of death. So my tell some stories really quickly. My background has been my dad used to mow the lawns at our family cemetery. So very matter-of-fact family, and my grandfather used to look after that cemetery, or what we call an urupa. And I guess it's those sort of backgrounds, like Amber was talking about, and some of other people that are here. When you grew up dealing with the dead, it's kind of a matter-of-fact thing. But then you wonder why your cousins kind of don't want to go too close to you, because you kind of, you're involved in something that's like, I don't know, bro, you kind of been around them dead people, eh? So you got to stay back. And these matter-of-fact ways of learning that become normal for us as children growing up and going into these cemeteries, nevertheless, it's about negotiating the boundary between death and between the living. And so as a young child, we learn that. It's something that becomes part of our everyday being. We understand when we walk out of the cemetery how to cleanse ourselves. We understand what prayer means and why prayer is used and the psychology of prayer, as well as also the spiritual well-being that can be maintained through prayer. So very quickly, Nō Hiakoe, from Where Are Your Bones? And I'm going to just be a little bit provocative. The last 3 or 4 years, my PhD students have been playing with the idea that being Indigenous is actually playing into the coloniser mindset. And we want to like step back a bit from being Indigenous back to what we mean in terms of kinship accountability to the land out of which ancestors come, as opposed to an ethnic identity that's gone global and calling ourselves Indigenous. It's great and it has great use, but we also must we also problematise it. And when you come out of a tribal or intensely kinship background like I have, the word Indigenous has no currency. But the word tangata whenua, the people of that particular land, that is key. And once we understand that, and that's right across the whole planet, so it's in the way that Anna was talking about, wherever you walk, you're walking on someone's whakapapa, on someone's genealogy, on someone's bones, on someone's identity, going back hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of years. It just happens we're the living today, walking on that land. How do we honour that land? How do we belong to that land? Are we the hosts or are we the visitors? And what is the reciprocity between host and visitor? So this is something that my students have come up with, what pre-Indigenous might actually mean, and it's in the context of museums in particular. Ethically negotiated spaces of co-production, so those who have read some of our Museum Rutledge series might know, understand that, around prestation, around belonging. Honouring cross-generational, site-specific relationships, inherently bound in a kin community-framed moments of mutual agency, for future inclusive benefit. I'll make this available so everyone can digest and think about it. I would unpack it if we weren't going to be kicked out. I'm going to like just let that float over your heads and just get back to some pretty pictures. So I want you to imagine museums as vehicles rather than the academically framed authoritative voice of capture. What a cool place that would be if actually museums were in service of our people, and a recognition that we have reciprocity, equal reciprocity amongst leaders. Now, the art of that reciprocity is actually based on who is the host and who is the visitor. And we often get so captured by repatriation around human remains being held in museums and they've got to give them back. What we forget is that those museums are sitting on ancestral land of a tribal group, a kin group. They've had to bear the shame of everyone else's ancestors in there, and they've had no say over it. And this is an important aspect of those seeking repatriation of their remains held in museums, first and foremost going through the front door of those whose land the museum sits on. That's the first healing that must be done, and a realisation of the shame that those people have had to put up with of having other ancestors on their land, not even buried in the land, interrupted in their reconciling their reintegration back into Papua Tuanuku, back into Earth Mother. So relationships to land, I mean, we're here in Australia, and this is one of the Darug peoples when we visited up Parramatta in Sydney, and it was just a fantastic interchange, cross-cultural interchange between our Maori leaders that had come in from Aotearoa New Zealand, watching this one of this mob walk up and down in front with a rubbish bin doing the smoking ceremony. And I'll tell you what, it was the first time any of my people from home had seen this, and they were kind of like in awe that this was the way of going into someone else's country. It was so outside their reference frame of reference. It was, and we had all our kids there watching this. There were about 60 kids watching this happen from home. It was a reminder that in as much as we think we've got the answers back in New Zealand, we don't have the answers. And when you start to explain Australia is tens of thousands of years old as opposed to we've only been in Aotearoa 1,000 years, you start to get a depth of understanding and a realisation that living in stasis with your landscape, with your whenua, with your earth mother's placenta, everywhere on the planet has different requirements, different responsibilities, different obligations, accountabilities and duties to honour that landscape, not just for you, not just for your ancestors, but for those yet to be born. And within museums, often the reason that most people, come back, come on, go. Oh, don't worry. Anyway, there wasn't an ancestor, he just decided to disappear. He shows on this screen, but he said, oh, I'm not going to talk to you guys, so I'm leaving alone. with our ancestors that are in museums, they do attract in the source communities, and the source communities in the Auckland Museum, which you saw before, which I worked in for almost 9 years, the engagement between the source community, the originating community of the ancestor, of the ancestral belonging, is negotiated through the home community, the home people, and then you have passing of that ancestor into the care of the home people to take home. Or, in some cases, they actually bring the ancestor back to the home community themselves, which is the preferred way that the repatriations I was involved in most times with the human remains. You actually had the home community would facilitate the coming in of the source community, would show them their ancestors, would look at how they want them packaged up and taken home, what way that they wanted them not only packaged, what prayers, what the protocols, and we'd have a discussion that sometimes went for months on this. And that discussion came after already many months of negotiation back in their home when they didn't even know that their ancestors were being held in the museum. While Chris and I were there working, I think it was over 1,000, about 1,100 or so ancestors' remains were in the museum. And of those, when we first started working, thanks to Cressida, we eventually identified almost 90%, 92% I think exactly, from where they had come. And stories Amber's shared with you and about the processes out of which they've come out of the land, excuse my French, but that's what my very good Indian friend from San Francisco said when I explained this. He goes, you know what, brother? Same shit, different tribe. So he was on the money. Point, though, of doing this, from a Māori perspective at least, is not about us, our generation. It's about the next generation. Again, it's been touched on today. Succession, the return of human remains or the practice of death is about renewing life, and we have to create a healthy attitude around that according to the rules that our ancestors have put in place. And I'm loving what Neil was saying about the remains being after a period of time, 2 years, are then secreted away into their caves. They become part of the landscape again. When the missionaries came and everything else happened, we decided to adapt our practice of doing more or less exactly the same thing, so that after a year, instead of lifting up the remains and now going and hiding them into caves, we now unveil a headstone representing that moment that we would otherwise have taken the bones and then secreted them away somewhere. So this is that moment, and that's the moment where we then can start to talk about moving on. So the grieving period's over. Now we're moving on. And again, it's about passing on what it means to be responsible, what it means to be accountable, carry obligations, to be in duty, to be in service to your people in a space of belonging, as opposed to owning the land, owning your ancestors. We actually belong to them. So talk about two things, kinship of the living, and the importance of us maintaining kinship of the living is predicated on our kinship of the dead. So this is the family Urupa, where you've got my great-grandparents, my great-great-grandparents, and in particular, there's some soil there from my great-great-grandmother that was killed in a battle in which the British bayoneted her. My grandfather eventually went to the battle site, lifted the soil from the battle site and brought her home so she could have proper burial. It's only when I was in my 20s and I visited one of our museums in Te Awamutu where we discovered a whole lot of sugar sacks filled with the bones of my great-great-grandmother and all her kin sitting at the back of the storage. Since been buried, but that's my lifetime and this, you know, good old colonial New Zealand. So our crisis today literally is the disconnection of our communities from their source of their identity, their home landscapes, their ancestral sense of being. Though they'll call themselves proudly Māori or even coming from the Hokianga or from Pangaru or from Te Aroha or from Kahungunu, it's really hard to maintain connection to a landscape that's been completely alienated into European title legal ownership, as opposed to three generations ago, you belonged to that land, the land serviced the whole tribe as best it could under some very brutal regimes of colonisation through Crown legislation. So there's just a couple of images just demonstrating some of the difficulties we're going through. And we do have opportunity to bring our young people to honour the dead. This is a ceremony where for our great-grandmother, who I previously mentioned, finally the battle site where she's killed, we were able to go back to that battle site, and now the Crown is recognising what's happened on that site and is talking about building a knowledge centre to help educate the whole country into the sacrifices made, especially by those who weren't Ngāti Maniapoto. And that was our tribe, Ngāti Raukawa. We stayed and fought to the last person, whereas Ngāti Maniapoto, they managed to get out and fight another day. But this was our home. We had no other home to go to. So I'm only alive today because her son wasn't there on the day. He was fighting elsewhere. So from a tribal perspective, and I was involved with repatriation for a number of years at Auckland Museum. Beside me was Rangi Iria, and this is Amber's relation. Cressa and I remember her really well. She spent most of her time going around all the different communities, talking to the elders, and she came from the whakapapa of one of our paramount leaders of the Central North Island that reached into all the different tribes. So using genealogy, she was able to relate and be accepted as a visitor into the hosting communities to sit down with them and say, hey, Auckland Museum has this, this and this that was taken from your land during this time from these particular caves through the research that Cressa had done, and how would you like them to come home? No pressure. Literally, no pressure. When you're ready, we're ready. Let us know. And this is how the conversation started. And you had to go through all of the stuff coming out. Because guess what? 9 times out of 10, there's one of those kin was involved in the removal of those remains. We always talk about it being the white fella that was responsible. Yeah, ultimately was. But they always found someone from another tribe next door that had an axe to grind with this tribe and knew where the bones were hidden, or was a family that had another thing against another family. We've hid our bones really well. So for someone to find them, you didn't accidentally find them. New Zealand at this time is just covered in huge bush. I mean, to accidentally find them was 1 chance in 1,000. But these guys were going in very targeted, knew exactly where to go because they were informants. So part of this going back into the communities was actually reconciling 3-4 generations of a hidden agenda of a particular family that had to be brought out to start the healing. So the healing had to actually start internally. So some of these tribes, knowing who those families were, at 2 or 3 years before they got to the point where they said, hey, we're ready to receive our remains home. 9 times out of 10, they wanted them to come home quietly, not with big ceremony, because they had already gone through ceremony. It was about putting them back into the land and continuing the flow of their reintegration into Papa Tuanuku. Their wairua, their spirit, had already ascended to Rangi Nui. This was now about the utu, the payment back to Earth Mother now of their bones returning, and the right for us to call that land our bones. So the word I've, in the last decade, I've probably been more hooked on rather than repatriation because of the red flags it creates in museums and everything else, is actually the word restoration. The restoration of dignity, the restoration of the balance internally, externally to the kin groups, the restoration of the relationships between museums, between the state, between older generations, younger generations, between the dead and between the living. So this is really about kinship being an ongoing continuum from life to death, back to life and onwards. And in particular, for me, it's really about the crisis our land and water is in today. I hook the whole removal of our ancestors from the lands through this process, or the forgetting of them, as part of the whole colonisation process, so that today 95% of Māori do not live on their home landscape anymore. They live in cities. They are 3-4 generations disconnected from their ancestral landscape, from the obligations that go with that. So they haven't learnt anymore from their grandparents, because their grandparents have also lived in the cities, what it means to honour country, to honour what you need to do to nourish the land and belong to the land. So consequently, this separation, which is now measured in our poor health statistics, our poor justice, violence, alcoholism, everything that all of us as Indigenous people know, it's becoming worse and worse. It doesn't matter how much money the government throws at it, it's not fixing it. And I go, like honour, right back to the point, right back to the source. Start with the process of restoring the land, restoring the bones into the land, and now restoring the sovereignty of the food to the land, the sovereignty of the water, so that the water now, instead of being full of cow shit, it's actually, we can recover our native proteins in that water. And New Zealand has an incredible diversity of proteins that are on the verge of extinction. Marine proteins, estuary proteins, and river proteins, lake proteins, that could feed all of New Zealand without one cow being born. We think that we need to be, have dairy, Fonterra, and everything else. So, and I'll just finish with an image of my daughter many years ago. I put this in for you, Chris. I bet you like this. This is how you remember Frida. He tupuro tere tere. Else our children will become drifting logs on the tide of humanity. Very famous elder, Māori Marsden, said that. And his concern was that we would end up almost where we are now, that our children are growing up without knowing how to tether themselves back to the land of their ancestors, and consequently, like I heard on the news this morning, 65% of all children with bad dental decay in New Zealand are now Māori. And that's the opening to all the other bad things that occur. So they're not eating well, they're not too many sugary drinks, they're living away from all the great food that their ancestors once used to provide. We need to find a way to re-secure them. So finally, I'm just going to play a quick YouTube clip it's a song that's written by some of you know, Smash Proof. It's an older clip, but it's about 3 young Māori men who have become very famous in New Zealand for their music writing, and they return home from living in urban areas to see what's happening back home. This is 2009, so this is like 9 years ago now. And the song just captures their heartache of what they see when they go back to visit their parents and their grandparents in their communities. So that was 9 years ago. That village, Minganui, every second home now is burnt out. It's depopulated, and the burnouts have been from PEAR labs, pure methamphetamine labs. They use the house so long, then they just destroy the house and move on to the next house. That's New Zealand reality right now, collapsing communities in the rural areas, all these home communities, and yet you'll see in the news that we've got some fantastic gains. We've got an economy apparently that's worth $60 billion per year now coming out of the Māori space. But the space out which I grew up and which I was my father took me out of when I was a kid, that space is more destitute now than it's ever been. So the disparity and the lack of the return of our human remains, despite all the good work we did in Auckland for those years, still three-quarters of those remains haven't gone home yet. And that'll be for another discussion another time. So thank you very much. Ka piti honu tātou honu te honu mate ki te honga pawairua. Ka piti honu tātou honu tātou te honga ora ki a tātou, tēnā koutou. Kia ora tātou. Thank you, everyone, for your time. Kia ora.
Well, we've got a good 10 minutes, I think, for questions and before we move on to a general discussion. So,
Paul, thank you for the wonderful presentation you gave. We're affected in our tribal communities by drugs and gangs and meth as well. And something that our elders have talked about over time is ways in which to reconnect with youth. And I was wondering if you could offer some perspective on that and what's happening in Māori communities.
The majority of the communities I have dealt with repatriations, they've not wanted youth involved, though there have been exceptions, more because of the shame around knowing how it originally happened. So when you dig deep, you start to uncover things that they don't want to expose their children to. In the same way my father didn't want me and my brother and I exposed to the violence and alcoholism that he grew up with. So he made a decision, and when we were young, took us out of the tribal community just enough. But we'd visit it every second or third weekend, but just enough so that we maintain contact but didn't get caught in that. Our youth today, I loved what I visited the Oneida people over in Michigan and the food sovereignty movement that's occurring. And I think there's some really good things happening because it's all about teaching the youth the importance of holding on to your heirloom foods, your corn, those things that your ancestors grew, and then trade them with other Indigenous groups. I think that's fantastic because they're relearning what it means to be part of the soil again. But for that to happen, you actually need to have the soil. You need to have sovereignty over your own soil to be able to have sovereignty over your own food. And that's the big challenge for us in New Zealand. We've only got 3 million acres or so left out of 66 million acres. And those 3 million acres are generally not that productive and very difficult to grow things. On the other hand, the land that we did lose to colonisation, highly productive, but we've got the Whitefella Pākehā communities at a point of crisis where they are starting to realise, having been in control of that land for four or five generations, that perhaps one of their major consumers could still be those who come from the land. So it's how we find a balance. It's that tuku rangatira, that reciprocity amongst the two different groups to work together towards a future that looks after our children. How that's going to occur, that's the fun part. Yeah. Thanks, that's a great question. Thanks, Honor.
Hi, Paul. Good to see you again. You mentioned that repatriation is politically fraught, and we've heard a lot today about the role of litigation for repatriation. But how do we get to a point where that's not required? What do you think is the key to getting past that?
I guess I shy away from the word repatriation because, to me, that's just saying ongoing colonisation because we're fighting against that. It's like, wouldn't it be great if we actually had museums offering to return our people home as opposed to us having to ask to repatriate them home? So a reflection of a true engagement of a relationship that's based on restoring the restoration of the mana, our authority as people. Maybe that it might be a museum like ANU that leads that, though they don't have remains to, quote, return home. They can take a leadership, like with Museums Victoria, and say, you know, it might be Mike and others. I mean, the Ainu is a great example. We've got the Ainu remains sitting in Museums Victoria, and if I'd had my way, they were going to be taken home, offered back, and returned home with the Wurundjeri people, bringing them home to deliver them to the Ainu. That was the plan. Now, whether that'll continue, I don't know, but that was what I was working on. And I asked, asked Mike, got some money there to help us do that, but yeah, and that could be the space out of which we've got to set some precedents. And if we can set some really good international precedents, like Te Papa has done in some spaces, this would be important. But the museums become the vehicle rather than the antagonist that's having to capitulate to Indigenous pressure under the concept repatriation. So that's kind of where I hope we go. Set.
Hi, thanks. Hi, Paul. Thank you very much for a great talk. I've listened today to a number of people picking up on this point around healing, reconciliation, and you kind of crystallising that in many ways in terms of restoration and relationships. And I think a lot of people here, having been involved in this for a very long time, think very much about relationships in this. But I wondered, I mean, having also been involved in this project and thinking about these things for a while, something that comes out very strongly is this notion of dignity. Dignity. And I find it quite a useful one when thinking about this space and the conversations about restoration and relationships and the dignity, like you were talking about, Ali, in terms of the ceremonies at handovers are about resetting that relationship between museums and yourselves, that and other people, that everyone can walk away with dignity restored. And I wondered whether, Paul, you might want to talk about that in terms of, or a Maori perspective on that concept of dignity, the philosophical background that it has in human rights. I mean, the Human Rights Convention, dignity is the primary thing from which human rights flow. And I wondered if others also might want to touch on that in terms of their philosophical perspectives from their own cultural backgrounds.
Yeah. The Hawaiian perspective is very similar to the Maori perspective. And I think Sir Hugh best summed it up. In order, and this is around the treaty settlement process, but I think it translates directly into the human remain returns dignity. He talks about dignity in the Māori concept of mana, of an authority that's bestowed on us from the Atua, of which we have a lifetime to nourish, to build, and to share. And given what has happened with the loss of land, exactly the same with the loss of our ancestors, that, and we can lay that in the space of coloniser, crown, the taker, Māori, the ancestors being the victim. His perspective on dignity was for the mana of Māori to be restored, we have to first forgive the aggressor. So in forgiving and showing compassion to them, then we restore our own mana. And it's not unlike what Paulo Freire talked about, but the pedagogy of the oppressed, where the oppressed must forgive the oppressor. His spin on it was a bit more about restoring each other's mana, restoring each other's dignity, so that you can move forward and then have a relationship that then is clean, and our children will no longer be affected by it on either side. One carrying the guilt and trying to live in resistance from what their ancestors done, the other carrying the shame of what has been done to their ancestors. So that's probably my response to that. Thanks, Cressida.
Thank you.
Hey, Paul, thanks again for that presentation. I always look forward to you, you know, and your thoughts and your idea, your experience. I couldn't help but you know, that last clip, and something that definitely, you know, concerns me from, you know, the Torres Strait is how we try and or attempt to make this agenda relevant to, you know, our youth or our young ones, because it seems that we're always up against stuff on social media and whatever that's more interesting to the younger generation. And I couldn't help but, you know, looking at that clip that you played right at the end and trying to draw, like, what it is that we have, you know, we could use, you know, to assist us. And some of your end comments about, you know, the issues that, you know, Maori face, and I was really shocked by some of the evidence that you use, and, you know, I shouldn't have been, because, you know, one of the things that I do to, you know, as to put food on the table for my family is I've, you know, got to work for the government, and a lot of the times I don't like what I do. But in doing that, I learn a lot about what the actual issues are in the Torres Strait and trying to work out ways to address it. And the biggest issue in the Straits right now is, you know, obviously health, you know, and because of where we are, you know, we're probably the only part of Australia that, you know, borders another sovereign nation and have a treaty where, you know, people from, you know, from our northern neighbours have free access and trade and interaction. And with a lot of good comes a lot of bad. And one of the things that haunts us today is, you know, the high incidence of STIs. And we're trying really hard to curb that, control it. And I saw that clip and I saw, you know, here's an opportunity that, you know, we could, or here's a medium or a way we could use to assist us in getting the message out, not only just about that, but about something that, you know, we're doing in this space. And I wondered, is that something that has helped, you know, to create that awareness, you know, to make what we do, you know, have its place where it should be, you know, really important, you know, front and centre if you want to heal things that have been done to us, you know, a long time ago. And there's a massive sort of gap between what happened then, all those generations up until now. I think I probably answered my own question. I think I'm asking you that.
I knew you were a Maori. we problematise and we provide our solution. One thing that does give me heart is that the new generation that are coming through that are diginatives, like my daughter and others, they're making their own songs, their own clips, they're sharing them with each other, and they're actually raising a lot of these issues that we kind of step back from, but they're getting right into it. Like the big one they're talking about now is suicide. And Māori suicide, youth suicide, it's just out of control. But it's now been spoken about by the kids, you know, at the ages 11, 12, 13, but in a space of, like, we're better than that. As opposed to, oh God, everything's doom and gloom, and there's, you know, there are major issues around violence and especially sexual within a lot of our families, and it's all come back again because of the socioeconomic situation we find ourselves. Majority of Māori live in cities. They can barely afford the state homes they're living in, and I think last count we had over 30,000 living out of cars in South Auckland, near McDonald's, and using the bathrooms and taking their kids to school, working nights. They just can't afford to pay the high cost of living anymore. And this is on top of the, you know, 200,000 plus who are living in homes but are really struggling. And then it's like down Wellington where Amber is, down around Port Aurora, and there's eastern suburbs of Christchurch, south Dunedin. It's something that is affecting us. The schools are starting now with the new government to actually look at addressing it directly in the schools. They realise that Māori now, the inherent subtle racism that's occurring. Some of you might have seen Taika Waititi's clip recently, basically saying racism is still part of New Zealand. We are still subject to it. Our kids have been subject to it. We need to knock it on the head. But how do we knock it on the head? By giving our kids the ability to stand up and confront it so that it doesn't carry on, and to have that mana, that dignity, that realisation, we're not going to be pushed around anymore. And that's what's exciting me. I'm seeing a new generation coming through that are so global in their thinking and seeing through the digital age. They're the new generation that aren't being seduced by the internet. They're actually using it as a tool to communicate and to reach out and understand what the world's really doing. And they really care about the planet. So this, for me, is a turning of the tide, I believe, is just starting to happen, 2018, at least amongst our people. So fingers crossed it's happening right across the world too.
Yeah, well, I like the way you put it, that you don't really like that word repatriation. It's more restoring, and to me that makes more sense. I mean, it's restoring dignity. We had our dignity taken away when our ancestral remains were removed and put into museums, and our grave sites were devastated and robbed, and it filters down. I mean, all the way through to our young people. They mightn't consciously recognise, but there's been damage done way back over there with all the things that happened to our people, you know, and it's still affecting, and unconsciously a lot of times. You know, little town Fitzroy Crossing, where I'm from, we had more suicides there than anywhere else in the world. In a couple of years, and you see, and even now, I mean, there's no dignity. The dignity has been taken away, and I've been working all this year on the cemetery project, where our ancestral remains are. From the late 50s up to the 80s, where Aboriginal people were brought in from the bush and just kept in Fitzroy Crossing because it was just a big mission. And they didn't have any right, and they couldn't go back to their homelands, or they couldn't even go to another town, you know. And they were buried there, and without a... any say, and then the river over the years started washing our ancestral remains away downriver, and you know, we took 70 remains out of the old cemetery, and they're sitting in a sea container in Fitzroy Crossing, and I'm working on the reburial up at the new cemetery. But it's about restoring that dignity that's going to make us move forward, and you know, we shouldn't be begging these museums to give back our ancestral remains, and it should be just a pure human dignity, respect that should be. Known by these people that are holding our ancestral remains, and this has got to be to our kids, to say that we are restoring our dignity through our the work that we do. And you know, I do my work as a repatriation officer. I'm an artist. I can sit down and paint a $2,000 painting in 1 week. But I do this work because I have been asked by the elders to do it, and I do it because I feel with the elders that I work with, they're the ones that are driving me. And a lot of our elders up in the Kimberleys can't even speak English, English is their second or third language, you know. But they want that dignity back, and they want those things that happen to us to be corrected. And like you say, no animosity. I mean, if a little kid goes and lights a fire and burns down half of the countryside, you know, you don't punish that kid for the rest of his life. You know, you just say, no, you've done the wrong thing. And this is what happened to us too. And this is what how the elders feel. You know, you come and took our remains, but you didn't know that you broke our dignity there. Bad boy. You shouldn't do that again. You know? And we don't want that happened again. And now you know, don't do that anymore. And that's what we want. And that's what dignity and is all about.
Thanks, Neil. I can't agree more, and I think the Ainu people summarise it best in that we are our ancestors, we are our bones, and if we can't transfer that to our children, we can't transfer the dignity that our ancestors once used to represent. And if they're stored in museums, those museums are the cemeteries, and now those cemeteries are right there amongst those kids living away from their home. How confusing is that? Both of them are separated from country in a way that just cuts to the very bone itself. Kia ora tante.
Thank you, Paul. I mean, I think that's a great note to actually kind of broaden up onto a wider discussion, but before doing so, I'd just like to thank you again for a really great talk. Thank you.
So now we'll open the floor to a sort of more general discussion, but I think, as Paul Turnbull said, that was a great point from Neil to go into this discussion. I have a query. The issue of respect and sort of forgiveness for the collectors was raised by Paul Tapsell. But I think, and the issue of dignity and giving people back their dignity. And I think there's also an issue of giving back dignity to the families of collectors through the act of repatriation. People, and I'd like to ask Neil if you wouldn't mind, Neil, what happened with the Merberg remains and the visit by the niece or great niece?
Erik Merberg led a group of scientists over from Stockholm to Australia, jumped off the boat in Derby, and he was an anthropologist, and he had other guys with him, entomologists and botanists, and they set up camp down river from Fitzroy Crossing, and they were collecting animal specimens and plants and all that, and Erik Merberg started collecting ancestral remains, our ancestral remains, and how our people were buried, put up in trees, wrapped in paper bark. He'd take them down from up there and sit in his tent at night and clean the hair and the skull, no, the skin off the skulls, and get brain matter out of the thing so that he could have a perfect skull and to take back to Sweden. And his party didn't like what he was doing, so they split up, and then the Aboriginal people found out that he was doing all this and they wanted to kill him, so he took off and went back to Sweden and went through Fremantle with the ancestral remains and was passed by the quarantine people down there, and ended up in Sweden. He went mad, and all he could see was Aboriginal people coming for him, and they sent him to all the different doctors in those days, and they nobody could find out what was wrong with him, and he eventually died, but he died a madman. And his brother's granddaughter knew the story, and back in 2001. She made the effort to come all the way from Stockholm to Fitzroy Crossing, and she wanted to come and say sorry and meet with the elders. And she came to Kallak, to the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre, and the elders were all sitting at the back and was waiting for her. And she walked in and she just couldn't stop crying, and she was saying sorry for what her grandfather did, or brother's grandfather's brother. And the eldest told her, you know, you're right, it's not you, and we have no bad feelings or animosity against you. Anyway, when our delegation went over to Sweden to pick up the remains, she was there, and she helped the elders put the remains in the boxes and helped using the electric drill to screw the lids on the boxes of remains. And we had a smoking ceremony. I wasn't there, but the elders who went over had a smoking ceremony, and she went through the smoking ceremony. And she felt cleansed, and she felt like a whole weight has been lifted off her shoulders. And the elders said, look, our spirits, our good spirits, our feelings are still with you, and we will look after you, and we will care for you, and you have nothing to worry about. And that was one complete repatriation that I think we did. And it's not the... if you there's a documentary called Dark Science, and if you watch that, it tells the whole story about it. And at the end of it, I say from the elders, all they want is to have those remains brought back, put back in the country so their spirits can rest. And once that's done, there's no animosity after that.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.